From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
With its military poorly trained and equipped, its economy in tatters, and once vaunted weapons of mass destruction largely dismantled by UN weapons inspectors, Iraq today represents a threat to no one.
Top U.S. generals and members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff say Iraqi President Saddam Hussein poses no immediate threat, but as more than 20,000 U.S. Marines are being readied for deployment in the Gulf by mid-October, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee prepares to hold hearings on Iraq. Every single, quote, expert that has so far been called to testify supports a war against Iraq. Then Filipino President Gloria Arroyo calls for an investigation into claims that a U.S. soldier stationed in the southern Philippines joined a military raid and shot a Filipino man in a remote village in the southern Philippines. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Top U.S. generals, admirals, and members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff are saying Iraqi President Saddam Hussein poses no immediate threat. The U.S. should continue its policy of containment rather than invade Iraq to force a change of leadership in Baghdad. But this doesn't seem to be stopping the hardliners in the Bush administration. The New York Times is reporting senior administration and Pentagon officials say they're exploring a new approach to attacking Iraq. They're advocating taking Baghdad and one or two command centers and weapons depots first in hopes of cutting off the country's leadership and causing a quick collapse of the government. More on those stories in a few minutes. We'll be speaking with the former U.S. Assistant Secretary General Hans von Sponeck and the former U.N. Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter. The London Observer is reporting Saudi Arabia is teetering on the brink of collapse. Anti-government demonstrations have swept the Desert Kingdom in the past months in protest at the pro-American stance of the de facto ruler, Prince Abdullah. At the same time, British officials are concerned Abdullah could face a palace coup from elements within the royal family they say are sympathetic to Al-Qaeda. Saudi sources said the Pentagon recently sponsored a secret conference to look at options if the Saudi royal family falls. U.S. forces may have breached human rights and then removed evidence after the so-called wedding party airstrike that killed more than 50 Afghan civilians this month. This according to a draft United Nations report seen by the Times of London. The preliminary UN investigation has been unable to corroborate U.S. claims that its aircraft were fired on from the ground. Four U.S. soldiers stationed at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, have killed their wives in the last 6 weeks. Fort Bragg is the home of the Army Special Forces. Two of the four soldiers killed their wives and then killed themselves. Three of the soldiers were from the Army Special Operations Unit and had recently returned from Afghanistan. Newsweek is reporting Attorney General John Ashcroft was expecting Zacharias Moussaoui to plead guilty to charges of involvement in the 9/11 conspiracy to blow up the World Trade Center and Pentagon. Ashcroft was scheduled to break off from a party dedicating a new Justice Department courtyard and then read a proclamation for the TV cameras just in time for the network news. But Moussaoui put a damper on the festivities when he suddenly withdrew his guilty plea. Now the case will go to trial September 30th. Justice officials say in public they're confident it won't change the outcome. But privately, some law enforcement officials familiar with the evidence are not so sure. Moussaoui's court-appointed lawyers are planning to argue he was a member of Al-Qaeda and wanted to harm Americans but was not part of the 9/11 conspiracy. Sources familiar with tens of thousands of classified FBI documents say there's no evidence that Moussaoui ever had contact with any of the 9/11 hijackers. Some documents even suggest internal FBI doubts over whether Moussaoui really was supposed to be the 20th hijacker, as justice officials have suggested. Rampaging Israeli settlers shot and killed a 14-year-old Palestinian girl, stabbed a 9-year-old boy, and wounded 8 other civilians in Hebron on Sunday. The settlers attacked an Arab neighborhood, smashing windows with iron bars, setting a house on fire, fighting with Israeli police, and reportedly injuring 15 officers. The settlers also beat Israeli journalists and smashed their cameras. The settlers were returning from the funeral of a soldier who Palestinians shot and killed in an ambush. Four settlers were killed by Palestinian militants on Friday. Meanwhile, thousands of Palestinians defied the army's 39-day curfew in Nablus Sunday, filling the streets and opening markets and shops. According to the New York Times, it was the first act of Palestinian nonviolent civil disobedience against the current military occupation. Brazil has unveiled a new $1.4 billion Amazon surveillance system to monitor drug trafficking, guerrilla movements, illegal deforestation, and endangered species smuggling. The system includes radar stations, early warning jets, and some 900 listening posts. Officials say they can hear a twig snap anywhere in the Amazon. The project is financed by the U.S. Import-Export Bank and is being built by Raytheon. In the middle of the night on Saturday, the House of Representatives passed by a razor-thin margin a controversial 300-page trade bill. The legislation gives President Bush fast-track trade negotiating power, barring Congress from amending new trade deals. The trade package also includes authorization to negotiate a 31-nation NAFTA expansion and global deregulation of food safety, accounting, energy, and other standards, new limits on enforcement of labor or environmental standards and trade agreements, and a program under which U.S. workers who lose their jobs due to globalization will receive some tax credits towards health insurance. 25 Democrats voted for the bill, and the bill won by only 3 votes. Public Citizen's Lori Wallach said, quote, "It has been a tawdry spectacle to watch the GOP House leadership and President Bush ramming through a trade bill promoting massive global corporate deregulation just hours after crowing about passing new regulations aimed at the corporate crime wave caused by the very sort of deregulation this bill promotes globally." In Pennsylvania, all 9 miners were freed early Sunday after being trapped underground for days. 3 remain hospitalized. And this news, 2 men were charged with murder early this morning in the deaths of 2 undocumented workers found inside their truck after a sweltering 12-hour ride that immigration officials said left at least 13 others hospitalized on a day when temperatures nearly were in the triple digits. Immigration officials said up to 40 people, including at least 5 children, were crammed into a truck loaded with medical supplies, leaving little room. A truck grew so hot on the trip from the Mexican border to the Dallas area that the people inside tried to cut a hole in the roof but failed. Each passenger paid between $1,500 and $2,000 for the trip. Ilana Ilaya, you are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Top U.S. generals and members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff are saying Iraqi President Saddam Hussein poses no immediate threat and the U.S. should continue its policy of containment rather than invade. According to the Washington Post, their conclusion is based in part on intelligence assessments of Iraq's chemical and biological weapons programs and his missile delivery capabilities. Meanwhile, British Prime Minister Tony Blair has been told by the British government's own lawyers that British participation in an invasion of Iraq would be illegal without a new United Nations mandate. But none of this seems to be stopping the hardliners in Washington. The New York Times is reporting some senior administration and Pentagon officials are advocating a new approach, taking Baghdad and one or two key command centers and weapons depots first in hopes of cutting off the country's leadership and causing a quick collapse of the government. Advocates of this so-called inside-out approach say it reflects a strong desire to find a strategy that will not require a full 250,000 U.S. troops. U.S. allies in the Gulf are quietly advocating the quickest and smallest military operation possible to lessen anti-American protests on their streets. But something close to 250,000 troops might have to be deployed to the region anyway to make sure any forces that drop into Baghdad don't become isolated or surrounded. Meanwhile, more than 20,000 U.S. Marines are being readied for deployment in the Gulf by mid-October. Russian media cite sources in the Gulf as saying the U.S. military has set up tent cities in Kuwait, Bahrain, and Qatar. U.S. weapons manufacturers like Boeing continue to work around the clock to meet the Pentagon's demands. Iraq reported U.S. and British warplanes struck southern Iraq again on Sunday. The assault was the second reported in less than a week in the southern no-fly zone. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee will hold hearings on Iraq this week. Every single so-called expert that's been called to testify supports a war against Iraq. Two people who have insider knowledge of Iraq who have not been invited to testify before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, but will be with us today on Democracy Now! Are Scott Ritter, the former UN weapons inspector in Iraq, and Hans von Sponeck, the former humanitarian aid coordinator for Iraq from 1998 to 2000. He served the United Nations for 32 years and resigned from his post in protest in February 2000 in protest of the U.S.-led sanctions on Iraq. We're going to go to a speech Hans von Sponeck recently gave in Madison, Wisconsin, an excerpt of that speech, and then we'll be joined by both men to talk about their assessment of the threat posed by Iraq and by the United States attack on Iraq. This is Hans von Sponeck.
I'm not a Scott Ritter. I'm not an arms expert. But during my last trip to Iraq, I had a very unusual opportunity. With me was the official German television. And I asked the Iraqi leadership to allow me to go to sites that were alleged by intelligence agencies and by Western media as having produced, again, weapons of mass destruction. And I went. It was my choice to go to Al-Dora. It was my choice to go to Al-Fallujah, two sites that have been identified. And what did I see? I saw Al-Dora in a totally destroyed state. This was a facility that produced vaccines for foot and mouth disease, and then biological weapons material. In 1999, I visited that facility. It was destroyed. Nothing. And a week ago, 10 days ago, it was in the same destroyed status in which I'd seen it before. Now, don't tell me that I need to be an arms expert in order to come to the conclusion that there is nothing one should worry about as far as that facility is concerned. The other one was in the Western Desert, west of Baghdad, the same picture. It was producing, or alleged to have been producing, chemical weapons material, and I saw only destroyed facilities, and I saw storage facilities where pigeons were nesting, totally harmless. They wouldn't choose toxic sites, I don't think. But the fact is, the site was not producing and was defunct. Now that is maybe more evidence that I can offer with these two sides than Mr. Rumsfeld and Mr. Wolfowitz have ever told the American or international public about why they think Iraq is so dangerous. They just make the statement, they do not back it up. Well, I am coming really very quickly to an end now. I just want to say the political landscape in the Middle East has changed dramatically during the last 12 months. Prospects for reconciliation, for a peace process within the Arab group of countries is clearly very good. The Beirut summit in March showed a reconciliation between Iraq and Saudi Arabia. There was a slight rapprochement, if you want, between Kuwait and Iraq. And between Syria and Iraq, good relations have developed. Jordan and Iraq have good relations. Iraq and Turkey have very complicated relations, but they have a lot of ties of a very strong nature. So the basis for reconciliation and for a dialogue are very strong in the Middle East. Why not use this? In Europe, people do not want a war with Iraq. In Russia, people do not want a war. The government doesn't. China doesn't want. Even opposition groups, Iraqi opposition groups, not all, I have to be very careful, but some have said they do not want. The Al-Hakim group in Tehran has said they do not want a war with Iraq. The Kurds in northern Iraq have said we don't want a war. We can't stop the Americans if they want to come into our territory, but forget about a northern alliance a la Afghanistan kind of staging area from northern Iraq. We don't want that. So why is it then, when Europe doesn't want, when Asia doesn't want, when the Middle East doesn't want, why then is the administration in Washington so insistent to go ahead with the war? I have some answers. Maybe you have some answers to this. Maybe we can have some exchange. But I would say, and I like very much what an official, and that's the last thing I want to say here tonight, is what a French official said last week to the New York Times when he said, it is important to build a coalition for peace, not a coalition for war. And I think that is what we have to take seriously. And I intend to do that, and I'm sure you also. Thank you very much.
Hans von Sponeck, former humanitarian aid coordinator for Iraq from the United Nations from 1998 to 2000, speaking in Madison, Wisconsin a few days ago, worked with the United Nations for more than three decades before he resigned his post in protest in February of 2000 because of the U.S.-led sanctions against Iraq. Joining us on the telephone right now from Chicago, welcome to Democracy Now!, Hans von Sponeck.
Good morning, Amy.
It's very good to have you with us. In a few minutes, Scott Ritter will also be joining us. But I wanted to ask you to follow up on this part of your speech where you talked about going to Iraq and visiting a what the United States is saying is a biological weapons factory of Saddam Hussein and what you found.
Well, this is the Aldora facility that originally produced foot and mouth vaccines. And in 1999, there was an idea to rehabilitate this facility with United Nations support. So I went there, saw it. It was in a totally defunct state. It had been destroyed, disabled by UNSCOM, the disarmament agency of the United Nations. And when I went back 3 weeks ago with the German television, the same state. There was absolutely not a single sign that anything had changed. It was locked up. That facility produces nothing, is a threat to nobody. And I don't have to be an arms inspector to come to this conclusion. The same applied to another site, which I had chosen also. Al-Fallujah has been mentioned in the press as another facility that might continue or that has restarted to be a danger to Iraqis, to the neighborhood. And I think it's almost a joke to argue a danger to faraway United States. When I went there, I saw the famous, often mentioned, castor oil facility producing brake fluids, but also substances that can be used for chemical weapons manufacturing. That facility was, again, defunct, disabled. There was not a sign that it had been producing anything for a long time. It was rusty, neglected, and half destroyed. And if that is the basis, Amy, on which we build a case for war or argue that Iraq poses a threat, then God help us.
We're going to break for stations to identify themselves, and we're going to come back. Hans von Sponeck was the humanitarian aid coordinator for Iraq from the United Nations, the equivalent of the Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, but quit in protest of U.S. policy in Iraq. We'll also be joined by Scott Ritter and then Kathy Kelly of Voices of the Wilderness, a U.S. activist who's going to begin a 40-day fast in New York outside the United Nations protesting U.S. sanctions against Iraq. This week, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee will hold hearings on an attack in Iraq. Stay with us. Aziza here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Hans von Sponeck on the line with us from Chicago, the former UN humanitarian aid coordinator for Iraq, quit in protest. You say you visited the two U.S. weapons, what the Western sources, intelligence sources, were calling biological weapons factories of Saddam Hussein, but that you thought that the charges were ludicrous, not backed up by the evidence, and that you went with a German film crew. Did you film these sites?
Absolutely. We filmed whatever we wanted to film. There was no obstacle in doing so. And yesterday in Germany, the first 8 minutes of that were shown, and there will be a longer version of that in August. But I want to say these are only two sites, and one should not jump to the conclusion there may not be something else, somewhere else.
But I understand BBC wanted to go with you to Iraq, but a high-level British official intervened.
I'm not aware of that. I know that the Australians wanted to come, and they didn't get a visa. So there was considerable media interest in trying to find out how it looks on the ground. And, you know, if you put one thing to another, you see a very weak Iraqi military on the roads. You see sites that were alleged to be a threat. You talk to people, including people who had been involved in weapon of mass destruction programs, and the distinct conclusion you have to draw afterwards. Iraq, as William Cohen said, please let's remember that, William Cohen on the 10th of January 2001 briefed incoming President Bush and said Iraq poses no military threat to its neighbors.
William Cohen, of course, being the former defense secretary and
right.
Before that a Republican
that's
senator
right.
from Maine.
And I should also add on the 17th of June, not long ago, former President Clinton at the Yale Club in New York said, hey, you people in Washington, get your priorities right. Emphasize your energies on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Forget about Iraq at the moment, because Iraq doesn't constitute a military threat at this point. conclusion seems to be the same everywhere except in this microcosm called Washington, where there is a determination to go ahead in implementing the Iraq Liberation Act of the U.S. Congress of October 1998, which calls for regime change.
In addition to Hans von Sponeck, we're joined by Scott Ritter, former chief U.N. weapons inspector in Iraq, known as quite a hawk at the time. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Scott Ritter.
You
recently wrote in the Boston Globe, while we were never able to provide 100% certainty regarding the disposition of Iraq's prescribed weaponry, we did ascertain a 90 to 95% level of verified disarmament. My question to you is, if indeed Iraq still has a small amount of chemical weaponry, isn't trying to bring down the regime the surest way to get them to use it?
Well, first of all, let's clarify something. Nothing in my statement implied that Iraq retains a small amount. I said we couldn't account for it. This does not automatically translate into Iraq as retaining it. It's a very complex environment in Iraq, one that makes establishing 100% of anything virtually impossible. When I say 90-95%, that stands for verified absolute certainty that it is accounted for and no longer representative of a capability. The missing 5 to 10%, however, does not mean that Iraq has it. It means we can't account for it. Now, to go back to your question, though, let's say that Iraq does have it. Let's say they hid it from us. Again, before we jump to the conclusion, I always have this problem with jumping to this conclusion that Iraq has it because, we have to parse this out. Chemical weapons. Especially nerve agent, the kind that we should be worried about as opposed to mustard agent, which in minute quantities is more of a nuisance than any militarily viable weapon. A nerve agent, shelf life, 5 years. We destroyed Iraq's nerve agent production capability. So for Iraq to have viable nerve agent today that they could use, they would have to reconstitute a nerve agent production capability. And, as Hans just said, it appears that the most likely plant used that could be used for that capability, Fallujah, is sitting out rusting in the desert. Biological weapons, liquid bulk anthrax, shelf life under ideal storage conditions, 3 years. So for Iraq to have anthrax today, they would have to reconstitute a production capability. If any camera crew bothered to go out to Al-Hakam, the old factory, they'd see that it is totally obliterated and basically bulldozed under the ground. So, where is Iraq going to get this capability? But now we go to the final thing. Saddam Hussein knows, and I'll say this right now, if Iraq is known or shown to possess weapons of mass destruction capability today, more than 10 years after the international community has outlawed this capability, Saddam is truly a pariah leader at the head of a rogue state that must be dealt with harshly. And I would support a war against Iraq. But Saddam knows this. He knows that the United States would have no problem whatsoever building a coalition to seek his demise if he has these weapons. Weapons of mass destruction represent a suicide pill for Saddam Hussein. And Saddam Hussein's about one thing, the continued survival of Saddam Hussein. So this talk of Saddam using weapons, this, that, and the other thing, A, it's totally baseless in terms of facts, substantive fact, and B, it makes no sense when one studies the psychology of Saddam. So I'd rather we focus on that than what the hawks want us to focus on, which is anything that legitimizes the concept that Iraq retains prohibited weapons capability today.
Scott Ritter, you're the former chief U.N. weapons inspector.
A chief U.N. weapons. There's many. There's no such thing as the chief weapons inspector.
A chief U.N. weapons inspector in Iraq. Can you talk about why the weapons inspectors were forced out? One of the people will be testifying this week at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearings on whether to bomb Iraq, which will be Wednesday and Thursday, is the former national security advisor under President Clinton, Sandy Berger.
Well, I think, it's interesting that I've written and spoke since day one. People read my testimony to the Senate in September 1998. They focus on my statements about Iraq's capabilities to reconstitute weapons programs within 6 months of inspectors leaving. I still stand by that testimony. There's no doubt in my mind that Iraq retains the technological capabilities that if the president of Iraq ordered it to be done, they could reconstitute limited production capability in chemical, biological, and ballistic missile fields. I still believe that, but that capability doesn't translate into the fact that they're really doing it. But I also, the main focus of my testimony was on American manipulation and interference of the inspection program for purposes that led to the triggering of military action and the utilization of UN weapons inspectors as a vehicle for the unilateral collection of intelligence information, we're talking espionage, on behalf of the United States. I said that in 98. I've been saying it ever since. Rolf Acacius, my former boss, and remember, Acacius was the executive chairman from 91 to 97, 6 years. Butler was executive chairman from the middle of 1997 till the demise of the programs in December 98, you know, just a little bit more than 1 year. Acacius says, without a shadow of a doubt, that there was U.S. pressure from the very beginning, and that under Butler, this pressure led to the discrediting of the entire program. But let's remember who Butler's deputy was, Charles Dulfer, who will also be giving testimony. Dulfer was in UNSCOM implementing American policy objectives, which had nothing to do with disarmament and everything to do with the destabilization and overthrow of Saddam Hussein. And while Butler was doing this and while Dulfer was doing this, the man overseeing this was Sandy Berger, the National Security Advisor under President Clinton. And I am personal witness to Sandy Berger picking up the phone and intervening on numerous occasions, directly interceding with the executive chairman or his deputy, violating the chain of command of the Security Council, violating the Secretary General's purview over this, and it was just direct U.S. manipulation. So it's not just Berger, it's not just Dulfer, it's almost everybody on this the panels that have been assembled by Senator Biden who are tainted and have a pro-regime removal standpoint.
Scott Ritter, could you amplify on that you were personal witness to these phone calls?
Well, I mean, I'm sitting in a room, the phone rings, Butler picks up the phone, it's Sandy Berger. That sort of makes me a personal witness to this kind of phone call. And I was there numerous times. One time in Bahrain, we're sitting in a restaurant in December 1997. I'm getting ready to go in and do an extremely intrusive inspection, which I had designed that was based upon arms control objectives. But the U.S. was manipulating the timing of this because they wanted confrontation. And it was being reviewed by the National Security Council in Sandy Berger's office, Sandy Berger personally, and Butler was hesitating signing off on this mission until Charles Dulfer receives a phone call from Sandy Berger in which he is told that the United States has given the green light on this inspection. Dulfer tells this to Butler. Butler signs off on the mission. So now, instead of me going forward to carry out a mission which is, you know, purely about United Nations objectives based upon the mandate of the Council, I'm carrying out a mission. While I think the content is pure, it's clear that the timing is being utilized by the United States for its own unilateral objectives of creating conflict with Saddam, justifying military action. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about.
Scott Ritter is a former chief UN weapons inspector, one of them, in Iraq. Also, Hans von Sponeck with us, who's left Iraq in protest of the UN sanctions against Iraq. One part of the story is biological weapons that the Bush administration is using to try to justify an attack on Iraq. The other part, which may be connected, is what they say are Saddam Hussein's links to al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. Can you, Hans von Sponeck, address this issue?
Well, this is, of course, part of a rhetoric build-up that we have seen ever from the beginning of the Bush administration to make the case against Iraq and a case for military intervention. It's fascinating to see that escalation in trying to make a case. And if looking back now, what we see is a house of cards that is falling to pieces, including very much the al-Qaeda connection. I was 2 weeks ago. I was in Iraq, including in Iraqi Kurdistan. Now the group that is linked, so the international press, to al-Qaeda is a small group called Ansar al-Islam or Junt al-Islam. These are people who are in the western, in the eastern part of Iraqi Kurdistan, 400 to 600 people, and apparently they do include a few Al-Qaeda supporters who have managed to escape from Afghanistan. But they are in areas that are not under the control of Baghdad. And even in Iraqi Kurdistan, the indication was that there was no direct example, despite of what we read in the New York Times and other mainstream media in the U.S., no evidence of a direct link between this small group of fundamentalists that include a few Al-Qaeda remnants and Baghdad. It's part of the picture of mis- and disinformation, just like the famous Mohammed Atta case, the Al-Qaeda man who allegedly met with Iraqi intelligence in Prague. It was farcical how this was tossed back and forth without any evidence, ultimately, that there was such a meeting. And even if there was, can one justify a military confrontation on the basis of a meeting between one person from the Al-Qaeda side and military intelligence from Iraq? I don't think so.
New PBS documentary show called Wide Angle in its premier program called Saddam's Ultimate Solution. It had a lot of shrouded people talking about Saddam Hussein's biological weapons capability and his links to Al-Qaeda. And afterwards, the media personality who hosts the show, Jamie Rubin, the spokesperson for Madeleine Albright's former Secretary of State, interviewed Richard Perle, one of the current fiercest advocates of the bombing of Iraq, who says that this film proved once again people's confirmed one's worst fears and apprehensions about the connection between Al-Qaeda, the global terrorist network that Perle said ultimately wished to destroy the United States, and Saddam Hussein. What about the role both of the Democrats and the Republicans as we look at this hearing that's coming up in a Democratic-controlled Senate right now in pushing an attack forward, even as we hear that U.S. generals as well as members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff are saying that Saddam Hussein poses no immediate threat? What are the divisions within the current government?
I think maybe Scott Ritter can better answer that than I.
Scott Ritter.
Well, what I would say is, you know, first thing we have to do is let's get a grip on what we're talking about here. If we were talking about Iraq as a national security threat to the United States, that would be one thing. But the fact that almost the entire Joint Chiefs of Staff of the American military, the Pentagon, anybody who wages war as a profession, who assesses threats as a profession, the men who would put their lives on the line, who are charged with doing this, these are not cowards. These are brave men. And they are sitting there saying, Iraq is not a threat to the United States, that this is not a case worthy of war. Remember, these are guys who take seriously their constitutional obligations to defend the people of America. And they also have a responsibility to the lives of the soldiers they lead, the Marines, the airmen, the sailors. So, and they're not wanting to rush off to war here because they don't see a threat. So it's clear we're not talking about a national security threat. So what are we talking about? This is domestic American politics. And both the Republicans and Democrats are stained by this. Remember, it was the Clinton administration that undertook, a Democratic administration that undertook the most vile abuses of the UN weapons inspection system. That was their policy. They destroyed the weapons inspectors. They initiated, this whole concept of removing Saddam Hussein by signing into public law the Iraqi Liberation Act in 1998. Republicans and Democrats alike in Congress endorsed this. So everybody is tainted. Everybody has invested political capital behind the concept of removing Saddam Hussein from power. So when we talk about a hearing, you know, normally one would think a Democratic-controlled Senate would hold a hearing that would be perhaps a little confrontational to the White House's point of view. But Senator Biden's gone out of his way to say, we aren't being confrontational. You see, what this hearing isn't about is what this hearing is about is not an objective, impartial search for the truth, but it's about reaching a preordained conclusion which justifies, you know, the passing of a senatorial or congressional resolution authorizing the President of the United States to use force. The Democrats are pushing through the Republicans to get even further right, more hawkish on this issue than the Republicans themselves to score political points. Saddam Hussein has become a boogeyman, which both Democrats and Republicans are using to achieve some sort of political dominance here in the United States. We have convinced the American people, when I say we, the collective government, because I do believe we the people are the government and we the people have failed. We've allowed these people in Washington, D.C. to define issues for us that are totally void of truth, totally void of fact. And they've defined an issue in Iraq which automatically gives, without question, weapons of mass destruction capability to Saddam Hussein, automatically gives a clear linkage to al-Qaeda, which doesn't exist, as Hans said. And therefore, we're not going to talk about the threat. We're going to talk about going after Saddam, how we're going to do this, what will the end result be. And both Democrats and Republicans alike are tainted by this. This is about domestic American politics, and this is one of the reasons why the entire world is utterly aghast at what's taking place, because if we go into Iraq, it will not just be a disaster for the Iraqi people, not just a disaster for American democracy. This will be a disaster for the entire world. And the world's rejecting this, but because we hold supreme power here in the United States, this unilateralist philosophy that dominates in Washington under the Bush administration appears to be moving forward unchecked.
Scott Ritter is one of the UN weapons inspectors in Iraq, who is now speaking out against attacking Iraq. Hans von Sponeck was one of the top UN officials who worked in Iraq for several years. We're going to come back with them and be joined by Kathy Kelly of Voices in the Wilderness. I also want to ask Scott Ritter about what he sees as what are the indications of a timetable for a U.S. attack, if in fact that happens. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. So Much Trouble in the World, Bob Marley here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we talk about what looks like what the Bush administration is beating the drums for, an attack on Iraq. The question, it seems, at least from the administration, is not if, but when, though a lot of people are working against that. Our guest, Hans von Sponeck, former UN humanitarian coordinator in Iraq, as well as Scott Ritter, who is a weapons inspector in Iraq for the United Nations. Scott Ritter, what indications do you have of any kind of schedule? And do you think an attack on Iraq could be somehow avoided?
Well, I mean, I still believe that there's a window of opportunity to derail this war. You know, at a very minimum, to pause the war. But, you know, as a former 12-year veteran of the Marine Corps who participated in the first war in Iraq, I have a little bit of an understanding of the reality of this issue. Although President Bush claims that no plans have crossed his desk, that's facetious. The fact is, we have ordered troops to begin moving into the region. We already have significant numbers, tens of thousands of American combat forces deployed in the area. We have people doing surveys in northern Iraq. We have secret bases being set up in Turkey and northern Iraq. We have surveys taking place in Jordan. We have expansion, massive expansion in Kuwait Qatar and other areas, Bahrain. And we have troops who have shifted their entire operational training schedule to be prepared to be deployed to the Persian Gulf region by mid-October to engage in combat operations. 20,000 Marines from the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force are scheduled to be, you know, pushed forward in this time period. The Air Force is to have many, you know, air combat wings ready, equipped with new precision-guided munitions, which the production of which has been accelerated by, you know, emergency appropriation spending from by Congress. And what this means is that while the president may not have signed off on a plan, on a given plan, we will be positioning ourselves for war. And when you take all this military power and you forward deploy it and lean it forward for combat, you've disrupted entire training cycles. The reason why our military is so good is that we train. We have the best leaders, the best educated troops, the best equipment, but it means nothing unless we always train. So when we lean forward and prepare for war, we've disrupted this training cycle. Now, we can get these guys razor sharp, ready to fight and win. But if we hold them in position for any period of time, I'm talking weeks or months, and don't use them, they lose their edge. They lose their capabilities. They no longer become as combat effective as they are. Therefore, the fact that we have them forward means that the president is given this option of either use these guys or lose this capability. So the fact that we've deployed this capability becomes the overriding concern, not the threat, not what they're there to achieve. And this is the danger. This is the danger of allowing this administration to position itself for war without some sort of clearly defined purpose, why we're going, without a meaningful debate in Congress, because then the war machine takes over and we go to war when there may not be a case for war. And in that case, there's nothing that democracy, common sense, logic can do to prevail upon this situation.
What do you think is motivating President Bush? And do you think the corporate scandals, he wants to divert attention, do you think that is too simplistic?
I think that's way too simplistic. This was something that was taking place well before that. I mean, it's a very simple thing that's motivating him. What's motivating him is political power. And we have a situation in which, you know, the gatekeeper to the White House, Karl Rove, who, frankly speaking, dominates President Bush's agenda, has bought into the thinking of the neoconservative hawks who have hijacked America's national security decision-making apparatus in pursuit of their own ideologically driven political objectives. And these people are using the boogeyman that they've created of Saddam Hussein to put in place policies that would otherwise not be implementable. I mean, you know, we're a United States who's always been a little bit arrogant, maybe a lot arrogant, but we have embraced, or at least pretended to embrace, a multilateral approach towards global solutions. And yet, you know, the hawks say, no, unilateralism, America first, America only. And they've used the war on terror, and they've sustained the war on terror by bringing in Iraq to promote not only unilateralist policy formulations abroad, but also some very damaging policies at home under the guise of homeland security, in which the individual civil liberties, which I, as a former Marine, swore my life to protect, you know, these are under attack, and this is what's happening. This is purely about domestic politics. This is purely about a handful of people who, under normal circumstances, would never get close to the reins of power, having seized the reins of power and now exerting this kind of influence on Bush. Bush is a man who, because he lost the popular vote and because there's controversy surrounding the Electoral College results, he's a man who has you know, been forced to fall back on the political base of the far right as his only foundation of legitimacy. And by doing this, he's allowed these hawks to hijack basically American democracy.
And yet it was his father, President Bush, who launched the Persian Gulf War, and he lost after this.
Well, his father, this is one of the things that Karl Rove continues to pound into George W.'s head, don't fall on your father's tracks. But his father's one of the few voices on the inside whispering into George W.'s ear saying, don't do this. His father is advising against this war. His father recognizes the folly of such a war. And yet the gatekeepers are, you know, we're at a situation where the gatekeepers are keeping the father away from the son.
And what about all of the politicians who are running for office again? I mean, to have an attack so close, they risk a lot both ways.
Well, they do, but because of the politics of demonization that have transpired here in the United States over the past decade, we have a situation where the only widely acceptable definition of Saddam Hussein's Iraq is of the personification of evil, the Middle East equivalent of Nazi Germany, of Adolf Hitler. And by couching Saddam in this manner, we have removed from the table entire ranges of options to deal with this problem. There's a whole host of ways to deal with Saddam Hussein's Iraq today. Military action is only one of them. But by defining him, casting him as evil, the personification of evil, we only present one possible solution, which is decisive military intervention. And the politicians understand this. For a politician today to step back and say, we need to reconsider what we're doing in Iraq, what he's telling his constituency is, we need to reconsider having better relationships with evil. That's a very difficult thing for a politician to do. So for the short term, politicians embrace the concept of confronting evil, even though they know in the long term this might have a disastrous impact on the American people. But these politicians, being as callously cynical as they are, believe that they can maximize short-term political gain and then ride out the storm, casting blame, trying to deflect blame onto others, not themselves. So, this is really, really a travesty towards, again, I come back, this is an assault on American democracy. It's a travesty for the American way of life that our elected representatives, allegedly working in our name, are carrying out such callous, politically motivated policies.
When you left Iraq as a biological weapons inspector and you were called the Desert Fox as you doggedly went after any place where you believed there were biological weapons, you were interviewed all over the media, as you said, continually Saddam Hussein has biological weapons. At the same time that you were plastering the media, Dennis Halliday quit because he called the U.S. sanctions against Iraq genocidal. He was the former U.S. Assistant Secretary General. He had the post that Hans von Sponeck followed with, former U.N. Humanitarian Aid Coordinator for Iraq. He hardly was interviewed at all. What about now, Scott Ritter, as you speak out against attacking Iraq? How often does the corporate media interview you?
The corporate media? American media interviews me quite a bit. I just need to correct the record here. I wasn't a biological weapons inspector. I was a weapons inspector, which means I was almost unique in UNSCOM. I had the mandate to go after everything. My team was investigating how Iraq hid capabilities, so I would track down chemical, biological, ballistic missile, and nuclear weapons. That's why I think I have a heck of a lot of credibility when I talk about the totality of Iraq's capabilities. Two, when I resigned, I never said Iraq had biological weapons. I never said they had any weapons. I said we didn't finish our job, and that based upon the UN's own definitions of the job we had, because they passed a resolution under Chapter 7, which found Iraq to be a risk to international peace and security so long as it possessed this capability, an incomplete mission means that Iraq, technically speaking, is still a threat. So why aren't we talking about getting weapons inspectors in to do this job as opposed to allowing the U.S. to manipulate? That's the record of what I was talking about. I never said that Iraq continued to possess weapons of mass destruction. The media loved my message back then. That was something that was widely embraced by, you know, many, because they could take what I was saying and shape it to fit to do what you just did, to say, Scott Ritter's speaking out, see, he's condemning Iraq, therefore that means Iraq has massive capabilities. Scott Ritter says that Iraq can reconstitute in 6 months, therefore that means Iraq is this threat. My message, of course, today is much more complex. Back then I focused solely on the legalistic issues surrounding our work, why the United States can't be allowed to manipulate, why Iraq can't be allowed to obstruct. But since the United States itself shredded this foundation of law by bombing Iraq in December 1998, we have to look for another way to solve this problem. It can't be simply about getting inspectors in to confront Iraq and then blowing Iraq off the face of the map. That's about truly solving not only the weapons issue, but the humanitarian issue, about the regional security issues. And this is very complex. I think I'm very well positioned to address this. The media listens to me, but whereas in 1998 I was almost unchallenged, I could go on a media show and say what I had to say, and people just accepted it. Then they brought in people to interpret what I said after the facts, but they left me alone. Today when I speak, I'll go on the air and I'll say what I say, but now there'll be two or three hawks out there to ambush me. And if I get too effective what I'm saying, they shout over me. They speak over me. Instead of dealing with the issue, they start personal attacks. You know, what's your motivation for doing this? Aren't you truly paid off by Saddam? You know, they attack the messenger. They ignore the message. That's what's happening today. I think my voice is way too powerful and way too credible for the media to ignore. So rather than ignore, I'm unfortunately for me, because I really don't like this, I'm on the air, both television and radio, quite a bit. But today it's much more confrontational than it was in 1998.
Scott Ritter and Hans von Sponeck are guests. They will not be testifying, at least at this point, before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. They haven't been invited. But anti-war groups, activists around the country are participating in a national call-in day today to demand that the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which is led by Senator Biden, call people like Ritter and Hans von Sponeck to testify at these Wednesday and Thursday hearings that will be taking place to look at U.S. military plans regarding Iraq. Kathy Kelly, founder of Voices in the Wilderness, which is a Chicago-based campaign to end economic sanctions against the people of Iraq, is one of those who is behind today's National Call-In Day. Can you talk about this day?
Well, we think it's really important, Amy, for people to call 202-224-4600. That's the number for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and urge that the panelists include voices that would present the kind of information that you've heard today, the voice of Hans von Sponeck, the voice of Scott Ritter, and of course there are others, including Dennis Halliday, Hans von Sponeck's predecessor, or the successor to Hans von Sponeck, Mr. Tun Miat. Now, it's a gold mine. All of these people are here in the United States. They're available. They've made it known that they're available. If somebody wants to reach Hans von Sponeck, important to give this number, 773-447-3964. Also call Senator Biden's office as the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He has great responsibility for the way that this panel has been organized. His phone number, 202-224-0139.
I think because it's hard for people to take down all these numbers, just the general number of the Senate is one where they can get through to these different offices.
Well, that's right. But the Senate Foreign Relations Committee number, 202-224-4651, would be the direct one to call.
And do you think it could make a difference? I mean, isn't the list set of the people who will testify at these hearings, it sound like they're being used to justify an attack on Iraq?
Well, then I think we also should be calling our media and saying that we want the media to do what you've done, Amy, to take a look at the lineup of the panel that's being assembled and to say this seems not to be objective, not to be balanced, in fact, to be an increase of the manipulation that's already put us in the very dangerous position that we're in relation to another attack in the Middle East.
Well, however you feel about this issue, to the listeners, you can call the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and let them know these are decisive hearings. It's a Democratic-controlled Senate, which the Bush administration needs as it moves forward with its plans. Again, the number of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, 202-224-4651. And that does it for today's program. I want to thank Kathy Kelly of Voices in the Wilderness, as well as Scott Ritter, former UN weapons inspector in Iraq, Hans von Sponeck, former UN humanitarian aid coordinator for Iraq, for joining us. We talked about discussing the Philippines and what has happened there with the U.S. soldier, allegations he was involved with the shooting of a Philippine citizen. We'll bring you that later in the week. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, and Anthony Sloan is our engineer. We wish him the best. He had a swimming accident this weekend. You can go to our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.